You're listening to World Class from the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. In this podcast series, we bring international affairs expertise from Stanford's campus straight to you. Russia, China, and the United States are three of the biggest players on the world stage, but relations between them are complicated. In this panel discussion hosted by the Richard Nixon Foundation, experts from FSI, or the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, talk about this trilateral relationship and whether the United States might help its negotiating position with Russia by improving relations with China. Panelists include FSI Senior Fellow David Holloway. He is the Raymond A. Spruance Professor of International History at the Center for International Security and Cooperation. The Shorenstein Asia Pacific Research Center Fellow, Thomas Finkar, is also featured, along with Oxenberg Roland Fellow, Carl Eikenberry. The panel was moderated by FSI Senior Fellow and Deputy Director, Catherine Stoner.
I'm going to start our discussion by picking up on the tape that Jonathan just played for us, which was Nixon's idea of formulating friendly relations with China to counterbalance Soviet power in the early 1970s. And he turned out to be very prescient in terms of not worrying about China necessarily in 1972, but worrying about China farther down the road. And so we find ourselves now in 2017 in an interesting and new situation where both China and Russia are important to the United States in global affairs. And since Mr. Nixon was president of the United States, of course, and opened relations again with China, rather infamously, we've had the collapse of communism in Eastern Europe. We've had uprisings in Tiananmen Square, of course, in 1989. We've had the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991. We've had a period of a weak Russia through the 1990s under Boris Yeltsin as it struggled to recover from both the trauma of 70 years of communism and the rather unexpected and sudden collapse of communism. We have 15 successor states as a result, including Russia, who are forging their own global relationships and partnerships. And in 2000, Russia began a rather dramatic recovery economically, and Mr. Putin came into office and has proclaimed that Russia is once again a great power, a power to be reckoned with. In 2014, Russia seized, or if from their perspective, took back Crimea and the Crimean Peninsula, have been sanctioned as a result since by the United States, by the European Union, but not by China, rather famously. In the intervening period between 2014 and 2016, China and Russia signed agreements on oil, Russian oil sales to China, perhaps as a counterbalance to American power. In 2011, the United States began a pivot, or repivot, to Asia from Europe to counter Chinese power in the China Sea, South China Sea. In 2016, of course, we elected a new president here in the United States, which has further thrown into question this trilateral relationship that Mr. Nixon, President Nixon, was obviously concerned about and very prescient about. So my first question to get our conversation rolling to our panelists is, what is the state of this trilateral relationship in almost August of 2017? Are we heading toward conflict? Is conflict inevitable among these three powers, or is an alliance of two against one inevitable? Or is it possible that we might be able to actually cooperate with either China or Russia? There are issues that should unite all three powers, North Korea being one, and its acquisition of nuclear weapons, yet it doesn't seem as though that has happened. So I'd like you all to comment, if you can, on the state of the trilateral relationship now. Tom, should we start with you?
Sure. Let me first thank Jonathan, the other organizers, thank Mr. Nixon for coming, and all of you for your interest in the program this evening. Let me approach the question that Catherine asked by posing one for all of us to think about, which is the extent to which the strategic insight that President Nixon had and acted on in the late 1960s was essentially a one-shot, reap tremendous advantage from complicating Moscow's strategic calculus by opening up the relationship with China, or is one that had continuing consequences for the way in which the countries interacted. I think it was mostly a front-end loaded. The U.S. reaped very, very substantial benefits from that relationship. Narrowing my answer to China, it was very useful to China's leaders to be able to pretend that they could use the strategic relationship to counterbalance the United States as China entered into its reform and opening program and accepted a high degree of dependence on the United States and the U.S.-led liberal international order. It was very useful for domestic political reasons to be able to say, we can counterbalance the Americans with first the Soviets and now the Russians. I think then and now are quite different. I think both Russia and China have far more at stake in their relationship with the United States than they do with one another. The area in which I see them having the greatest congruence of issues is in the United Nations, in the Security Council, where both of them have a statutory seat and their desire to have issues in the United Nations. But I don't think there's a lot for Americans to worry about in terms of a two against one alignment in which we are the odd man out.
David? First, let me add my thanks to Jonathan for inviting us here this evening, to Mr. Nixon for being here, and to all of you for coming to the panel. Let me pick up at exactly the point that Tom finished about, he said the U.S. shouldn't be too worried if Russia and China had good relations. And I think the first point to make is Russia and China probably have better relations now than at any point since 1972 when President Nixon made that remark. In fact, in 1969, the Soviet Union and China had very nearly come to war over partly over border disputes, but also rather deeper ideological divisions. I spent the morning here working in the archive looking at documents relating to the U.S. policy towards the Sino-Soviet conflict of 1969. And of course, it was very difficult to know how dangerous the situation was, but we do know at the time, but we do know from subsequent testimony that in fact the Chinese leadership was very worried about the possibility of a Soviet attack. And so I think President Nixon's move to draw, first of all, in the short term, to use relations with China as an instrument of pressure on the Soviet Union, as I agree with Tom, that worked. And in the longer term, it was a very wise decision because his argument was, when China is a very powerful and important country, we have to have lines of communication open to it. And I think that was the extremely important element in the policy. So if we look from there to the present, we see, as I mentioned, Russian relations with China much closer than at any point since 1969, 1972. And in fact, earlier this month, before the G20 meeting in Hamburg, there was a separate meeting in Moscow where the Chinese leader Xi Jinping spent 2 days in talks with Vladimir Putin. And they did make that comment that Russian-Chinese relations were better than they had, really, than they had ever been. The question is, what is the nature of that relationship, and is it harmful to the United States? So let me not go on too long, but I think the nature of the relationship is that for Russia, China has become an important market for energy and for arms. It's also a big and important neighbor with whom it's, from a Russian point of view, it's certainly in Russian interest to have good relations with China and not to get into situations of conflict which might threaten war. But it's also, in many ways, a default relationship. Russia is much weaker than China economically, not militarily, not in terms of nuclear weapons, but economically certainly much weaker. And its relations with the West are really in a terrible state, partly, perhaps mainly as a result of Russia's own policy in Crimea and in Ukraine. And I think that from a Russian point of view, this isn't an entirely satisfactory situation. They would like to have good relations with the West and good relations with China. It's not a matter of saying, oh, yes, in the early post-Soviet years, we wanted to be strategic partners with the United States. That's not worked out. Now let's be strategic partners with China. I think they would like not to be forced into a relationship, which is really, I think, a somewhat subordinate relationship to China.
Great, thank you. Carl, do you want to talk about China?
First, thank again, Jonathan, and the Nixon Library, and thank you, Mr. Nixon, for being with us this evening. So perhaps 3 points to go back to the tape from President Nixon. As we talk tonight about this triangular relationship between Russia and China and the United States, important to look back in history, even as we talk about partnerships and alliances today, and remember that we can often get it quite wrong, and we have gotten it quite wrong. So President Nixon in 1972 had the wisdom and the strategic courage to go to Beijing. But it was evident to many scholars, and I think many in the intelligence community in the 1950s, that there already was an opportunity at that point, as China and the Soviet Union at that time were having very sharp differences, which were just missed until the 1960s. Indeed, the United States relationship with China through the 1980s, there was a kind of romantic notion of this relationship with China, which the United States has periodically had through its history from the late 1700s when we began to trade with China in the World War II period, and then these wild swings from World War II to communism to the Korean War. So with the opening of China, then a more romantic view of China, which was not sustainable, and indeed it was not at all sustained as the events of Tiananmen, and then the strategic rationale for the relationship between the Soviet Union and the United States disappeared with the collapse of the Soviet Union. The second point is that the diffusion of global power that is ongoing today, so we talk about the rise of China properly, but there's a rise of India, there's a rise of many others, and on a relative basis, certainly Europe is going down. We can have about a debate about the United States in a relative basis. So any talk today about the triangular relationship also needs to come to grips with this triangle is in a greater strategic context, and it's not just the three of us. It's a lot more than that. And then the third point is with regard to the relations between the United States, Russia, China today. And here I would have a different take than my colleague Tom Finger, where I do have perhaps more concerns than have been than he had expressed, and maybe we can have a conversation about this this evening. So clearly, Russia and China, the strategic relationship has evolved since the 1990s, and there it was called the Axis of Convenience, and now it's a strategic partnership, and there's real security cooperation going on. There's arms sales from Russia to China that continue. There's military-to-military dialogues. There's military joint exercises. I don't want to overstate that, but there is an idea about trying to cooperate globally to preclude the United States from gaining global hegemony, trying to push back. Now, as that translates out, they have their own differences about how you should operationalize that, so to speak, in different parts of the world. But something that I think is understated, and I'll finish here, is that I do believe that there's an ideological component to this relationship, at least between Mr. Xi Jinping and Mr. Vladimir Putin. They are both tough autocrats. And both of them, whether it's Vladimir Putin looking at Maidan in Ukraine, or whether it's Xi Jinping looking at democracy in Hong Kong, they find a comfort in each other in terms of looking at the United States as potentially undermining with democratic subversion their grips on power.
Okay, thank you. Okay, I like that there's some disagreement, so we can mix it up a little bit. I want to get back to this issue of the trilateral relationship and whether we're in a multipolar world now or a unipolar world. In the Cold War era, we were obviously always thought of ourselves in a bipolar world, and so Mr. Nixon, President Nixon's introduction of China into the relationship were prescient to see that China would be important globally in a few decades. It is interesting to think about when he really made that decision in the context of a bipolar world and distribution of global power and authority between the Soviet Union and the United States. So here we are in 2017, and when I was recently teaching a course, I guess last spring, I mentioned to some international policy students at Stanford that I thought we were in a unipolar world. Sometimes I do these things to try to trigger a reaction. And the reaction was, what? Half of our students are foreign students in this particular program, and their perspective was, no, we're in a multipolar world. The United States is not as powerful as it once was. I happen to be working on a book now on Russia's resurgence and how we understand power, and so I was a little bit sympathetic to that argument. But another argument was that China is now overtaking the United States in terms of its percentage of the global economy. Russia stayed relatively flat, around 3% of the global economy. I think China is now up around 26%. The United States is about 19% of the global economy. So that's not per capita GDP, where the United States is still a leader. But China is has long been said is on the rise, although maybe stable or cresting now. Is the United States still much more powerful than these two countries? What does power mean in 2017 when, you know, Russia is a much poorer country, spends less on its military, is very dependent on oil revenues for its budget, and yet what we're talking about now in the United States is how it was able to, quote, shake the foundations of American democracy by allegedly hacking into the Democratic National Committee and possibly even into local electoral offices. So what kind of world are we in? Is it now multipolar?
Are these the three big powers that we should be thinking of and watching? And are these, is this trilateral relationship particularly important now? Or is the U.S., on the other hand, still the preeminent power? David, you're looking at me, so I'll have you start. Yeah, you made the mistake of making eye contact.
I won't make it again. The, I think this actually is an absolutely key question. What kind of world are we living in? Are we seeing the formation of some kind of new international system, and what will it look like if and when it emerges? There's a huge amount of commentary and discussion on this. I'm not sure what the new system will look like, but I think we're not in the old system. It's not bipolar. It's not, I think, the unipolar moment that was invoked after the collapse of the Soviet Union. It is, if not quite multipolar, I think, trending in that direction. In their meeting in early this month, Putin and Xi called for a multipolar system, and I think the fact that they're calling for it means we're not quite there, at least to their satisfaction. The second thing is that, yes, we can talk about the triangle, and I think the triangle is triangular relationship is important, but yes, India is potentially an enormously important power in the coming decades. The European Union at the moment is economically powerful, but very inward-looking, trying to cope with its own problems, and therefore not, I think, a major force internationally. Japan is also preoccupied with its problems. But I think we're seeing a world where we shouldn't, and I agree with Carl on this, we shouldn't focus just on the this triangle. It's a broader picture. That's one thing. The second thing is that we're still, so the first thing is it's not the bipolar or indeed the unipolar world. Secondly, we have a changing cast of characters in terms of the states that matter. And the third thing is that I think when we think of China today, it's not China in 1969. When we think of Russia today, it's not Russia of 1970. I mean, these are much more open societies. Yes, they're authoritarian, but nevertheless, technology has made an enormous change, information technology access. So in Russia, it's not today like the Brezhnev years, when it was very difficult to find out information about what was going on outside the Soviet Union. Now everyone has access to the internet, or actually it's very high internet use in Russia. Also in China, and yes, there are sites that are blocked, more so in China than in Russia, as I understand. But nevertheless, clever people find ways around those. So I think even the category of a state and the kind of control a state can exercise, that's being challenged by technologies. And that's another factor, I think, of great importance. So I think one other thing is that whether this President Trump is a symptom or a cause of a shift in American thinking about world order, at least some of his statements have called into doubt two of the very important pillars on which the liberal order that the U.S. largely created after World War II depended, namely alliances. I mean, questions about NATO or the commitment to South Korea and Japan. I know they're reversed, but nevertheless, there's an issue has been raised. Or multilateral trade agreements, which are also an extremely important part of American policy. Now, we don't know, will there be a reaction to this? Is this a symptom of a longer-term change? Of course, that's always the question when you're in the middle of change, is you don't know, you know, what's transitory or what's long-term. But I think those are issues that we have to confront. I think that then the question is, say, for U.S. policy or for Russian or Chinese policy, is what kind of world order do we want? What kinds of relationships would we like to have with China in 10 years' time or with Russia in 10 years' time? what would be most advantageous, say, to the United States, or each country has to think in that sense of its own interests. What degrees of cooperation are important? What degrees are we headed for protectionism, which I doubt we're heading for in a very serious way, but nevertheless, these issues are raised, and I think to decide on one's own position on these questions, one has to have some sense of what would be an acceptable or more than acceptable world order to foresee, let's say in 15 years. So President Nixon is looking 15 years ahead. Can we look 15 years ahead?
Great question. Carl, do you want to look 15 years ahead?
Well, the question about Russia and China and the United States, just assessing the relations now through different indicators. In the area of defense military, you had given some metrics on economy. So the United States spends, with its defense budget, 40% of the world's total on military spending, United States of America. China's number two, and it's about 15% of global spending, but coming up steadily. Russia's number three. Now, just military spending is not the sole indicator. Very important is what is that money being spent on, in what context, for what kind of contingencies. So it's true that in the case of Russia, we do have very sharp differences that are of security concern, and those are mostly on Russia's periphery. So in Eastern Europe, to an extent in the Caucasus, it has historical interest in Syria and the Middle East, and Putin's playing that out. And it's simply because of the expanse of Russian territory that as Russia looks at all its border areas, it, I guess in a sense, it's global in its security concerns. In the case of China, in terms of the way it looks at its security, is primarily a Asian power at this point, starting to get global interest, but primarily in Asia, concerned with the Korean Peninsula as we are, and with its maritime claims in the Western Pacific. And the United States were truly a global power in every sense. In this domain of security, though, globally, as I talked about who is spending what on defense, of the top 10 defense spenders, well, you have China and Russia, 2 and 3, but the other 10, led by the United States, are either allies of the United States or they're close partners and friends of the United States. Second point on the economy, and Catherine had led with that, and so the United States and China together, we're about 40% of the world's GDP right now. And if you look at global trade and investment, although the Chinese are moving ahead in trade, between the two of us, still pretty dominant. Russia is number 8 in the world in its GDP. So as in a way during the Cold War, where we concentrated on its military and on security issues, like the Soviet Union, it's playing a very weak economic hand. The third point would be on then our soft power that we have to bring to bear. And the United States, still today, with all of our difficulties that we're facing, still is a pretty inspirational model. There is no inspirational Chinese model. Some talk about a development model, but no one embraces a Chinese political model. And the same, of course, is true for Russia. So I think at times, especially as we're having difficulties at this moment in our history, that we can tend to start to take stock of our fears and not recognize still today how strong that soft power is. If the United States still wants to show the leadership to continue to try to manage the remarkable set of economic and diplomatic institutions it put in place at the end of World War II, I had a trip to Singapore several years ago, and I met with a very good Singaporean diplomat named Tommy Koh, who Tom Finger knows well. And I was talking to Tommy about the United States in Asia worry about competing with China. He said, what's your advice? And betraying my military background, I thought that Tommy Coe would say, well, Carl, you need to get three more aircraft carriers out here. And Tommy said, Carl, you need to get the New York Philharmonic Orchestra here. And that was his point entirely. Deploy the New York Philharmonic Orchestra. That representing what is very good about the United States in terms of who we are as a people and these institutions which we've established.
Okay, Tom, do you want to comment on this quickly? And I want to get back to some of these
issues. I do. I think I'd like to both address the question you posed and build on what Carl and David have said, because I think these are important points. And I'll be more underscoring than certainly challenging. What kind of a world is it? That it is certainly not bipolar. That sometimes it's multipolar. It depends on what the issue is. It depends on what the relevant questions are. Sometimes there are no poles. This is sort of nobody's in charge. It's a free-for-all. But to pick up on points of that Carl is making, if we think of a pole as the organizing center about which other countries align themselves and group, that militarily, the U.S. alliance system has no equal, nothing even close. China has one ally, formal ally, it's North Korea. Doesn't add much to China's national power. Russia has, I think, only Syria, if that qualifies as an ally. But Carl's point is, if we're going to think about military power and the uses of the elements of national power related to the military, which are not just fighting ability, the amount of transparency, of interoperability, connectivity, integration that is necessary to undergird these alliances that are terribly important to political integration, to economic integration. A second type, of course, is economic integration. That back in President Nixon's day, it truly was a bipolar world. You were in the free world and the liberal order, or you were in the Soviet socialist order of technology transfer, investment, economic integration, or you were in the very large category of the non-aligned states that kind of floundered with a pox on both of your houses that want to join in. Now there's one game in town, and that is the liberal order, that is the extension of what was the free world order. And almost all countries participate in it, almost all benefit from it. It is a rules-based order, not an ideologically based order. And the interconnections and overlapping relationships are very, very numerous. And the third is, Carl, is soft power, the power to attract. And I'll simply assert, to underscore, the U.S. still has enormous soft power. People would like to be sort of like us. They'd like to have their political act together perhaps better than we do now. But the total package of individual freedoms, civil rights, human rights protections, political participation, economic prosperity, military strength, who would you like to be like? You'd like to be like the United States, more than you'd like to be like China or Russia. So there's not much positive appeal there. The importance of economic ties, that China remains enormously dependent on the United States and on the United States allies for its sustained economic growth. China is the largest trading partner of most countries in the world. That point is often made. Seldom made is the relevant next point. Most of that trade is in the form of intermediate goods that go to China for final assembly to be put in a box to go to the United North America Japan, and Europe. Which way do dependencies go? 25% of China's exports come to the United States. 40% of China's exports go to the United States, Japan, and South Korea. 80% of China's exports go to those three countries plus the European Union. 7% of US exports go to China. That's a very, very disproportionate kind of interdependence. And for China and for Russia, they can't do much for one another that would really accelerate, sustain, step function, transform their economic strength, their ability to bring prosperity, their ability to fundamentally change their military capabilities. They both need factors, relationships available in the West more broadly. Do each of Russia and China seek to gain some opportunities and advantages by dangling, we'll become closer friends with one another? Of course they do. We don't have to fall for that. Look at the hard numbers. I would disagree with Catherine. It's a different set of numbers. I think yours are based on PPP and of numbers. That the World Bank numbers show the U.S. share of world economy is still around 24%. That's down a whopping 2% since 1979, when China began its fabulous rise. So we've dropped 2%. China's share of world economy by the World Bank numbers is about 17%, which is almost exactly the same as China's share of world population. The U.S. 24% of world economic product is achieved with 4.5% of the world's population. Measured with those kind of indicators, the gap is widening.
Okay, yeah, so when he says PPP, everyone knows purchasing power parity. So if you went and bought a basket of goods in China and Russia, it's trying to compare how much those would cost, relatively speaking. So yes, I was using purchasing power parity numbers, not gross domestic product numbers. But undeniably, China is on the rise, and the worry, and certainly I think part of the explanation one often hears for the rise of Mr. Trump and populism here in the United States is a concern that we don't make anything in the United States anymore. And that we've lost manufacturing, and instead this is being outsourced to places like China, but also to other countries in Southeast Asia that maybe produce things more cheaply than we can here in the United States. So that's a concern. I also wanted to get at this issue about soft power that Carl raised, which is the power to attract as opposed to force, right, and hard power and military power. So when we think about the rise of China, if there is a rise, and we think about a resurgence of Russia and certainly a more aggressive foreign policy, I want to raise the issue that perhaps actually that Russia has more allies in China, but Russia in particular has more allies than you mentioned. So Turkey could be one. Another budding autocracy, Syria, you mentioned, not exactly a winner, but for Russia it's important because it is reinserting interests in the Middle East and a concern that the United States was running roughshod and, in Mr. Putin's words, basically messing up, making a mess of the Middle East. Iran, Russia is now anxious to sell even more arms to Iran than it has in the past. Brazil. That is one of the few countries that Russia has no visa regime with. Russia also, and Mr. Putin has more recently, presented Russia as a conservative populist alternative to hedonistic, as he would call it, gay Europe. It is anti-liberal, and proudly so, and there is a certain pull to that in countries like, for example, Turkey, or at least the government of Turkey.
It also has developed relatively sophisticated methods, as I think we've felt here in the United States, of soft power in terms of inserting the opinions of the Russian government into our own political discourse. I'm always surprised because I actually watch Russia Today, which is RT. If you've ever watched RT, you may not know that that's RT, Russia Today. By the way, the Ukrainians, as a sort of funny aside, started their own network called Ukraine Tomorrow in reaction to Russia Today and what they were saying about Ukraine. But present a, in some ways, subtle, but in some ways very slick, in other ways very slick alternative to a U.S. Western liberal perspective on the world, and this is broadcast globally. You can, if you're in Dubai in a hotel, you'll see RT. You can see it actually in, probably in your local cable package here. There also, you know, news and information trolls. I have had the pleasure of being trolled on Twitter by Russian trolls. Cyber hacking. Some people, one person of importance in particular, is very doubtful that the Russians have this capability of cyber hacking, and his friend Mr. Putin told him they don't. And if they did, they'd never be caught. There's also this other sort of pull of order versus the chaos of Europe and migration and two open societies. So, you know, one could argue that there is this soft power component that Russia has that in a way the Soviet Union didn't. You know, the Soviet Union, the dispute in a bipolar world between the Soviet Union and the United States was really one of communism versus capitalism. And that's not exactly the dispute now. It's one of conservatism and order versus liberalism run amok and disorder. So I wonder about that. I wonder if you're worried about that and whether it makes a difference that these are autocracies, whether Russia and China are the same kinds of authoritarian governments, and the United States is still, you know, the shining light on the hill that it once was, or is the United States' international presence the same? Does it have the same power? Do we have the same pull as we had perhaps in the 1970s and 1980s anymore? Carl, you made eye contact briefly. He looked at me sideways.
I had my eyes covered.
Next time we do this, y'all wear sunglasses.
Well, a couple of points. First of all, with regard to Russia and its friends and its appeal, I hesitate sitting between two very distinguished Russia experts. But the history of Russia would indicate, and today's Russia would indicate, and how those on its borders, which have long histories with Russia, react to it, that I don't believe that it has a lot of appeal. If you look at how Eastern Europe is reacting, trying to get NATO to get more involved.
Although we have Poland. We have Hungary, authoritarian rollbacks, arguably, but okay.
Right, but not right. Not pushing towards Moscow. If you look at the Caucasus, if you look at Central Asia with their own concerns about Russia. Now, I think getting back to the triangle, if we talk about Russia's security relations, that Central Asia is going to pose a great challenge for the Russia-China relationship, because none of the Central Asian republics, the five stands, so to speak, particularly persuaded by the models of either Beijing or Moscow, but certainly responding to Chinese investment, which is going into Central Asia in a big way. So if you compare Russia's trade with Central Asia to China's, you compare the levels of investment of Russia and China, it's Moscow's being eclipsed. And that's historically been a sphere of influence. At one time, it was part of the Soviet Union. So I think there's going to be contradictions between Russia and China geopolitically in that region, and never mind the models that they offer. So I tend to be optimistic in looking at the United States and looking at our way of government, looking at the European model and our traditions. And that at the end of the day, the systems that have evolved, supported by robust institutions, and our institutions here in the United States are still proving to be robust, that they have much more staying power than the rule of man. So rule of law usually trumps maybe that was a bad choice of words. The rule of law usually does prevail. I think for the United States, though, that we can't have our head in the sand. So as we look at China right now, do we say smugly, that's a system that's doomed to fail? Well, people for about 30, 40 years now have been saying consistently, China's going to run out of steam politically, economically, there's too many contradictions, and still today it's doing well. So for the United States, whether we look at Russia or China, I think that getting our political house in order is important, but it goes beyond that too. So if I go to China, to most of their airports look much better than our airports. If I am on a Chinese high-speed rail, I'd much rather be on that high-speed rail going from Beijing to Shanghai in terms of comfort and indeed safety than I would like to be on an Amtrak train rolling from Washington, D.C. to my home in Raleigh, North Carolina. If I look at education in the United States, we've got some severe problems, and we don't have a monopoly on doing it right. There's things that are going on in China, probably for that matter in Russia, which I don't know well, that are things that we should perhaps emulate. When I look at how much money China is putting into research and development and focusing, I worry about that too. So I think it's a dual problem here. It's a problem politically, but if we can get the House back in order, great confidence. But part of that political will also has to be in getting our house in order, prioritizing what needs to be done so our sons and daughters and our grandchildren are going to have the basic infrastructure and capability in this nation to take then the advantage of these wonderful political institutions and carry forward.
Okay, thank you. David?
I think the argument about soft power is true. American culture, the American experience and example has had an enormous influence around the world. And Russia does try to exploit soft power in terms of religion, in terms of art, and so on. But it doesn't stretch nearly as far as U.S. popular culture does. On the other hand, I am somewhat surprised by the, maybe I shouldn't be, by the number of political rulers who seem to admire Putin. I don't get it myself, but, you know, yes, he's a strong man, a strong leader, and, you know, he seems to be in control of things. And there are lots of states where actually that's an issue. You know, what kind of control does the government have? What are the barriers to the emergence of dictators? And they may say, well, here we have an example, you know, successful ruler who's pulled Russia. I mean, this I'm going to criticize this version in a minute, but who's pulled Russia out of the kind of chaos of the 1990s to introduce stability, reassert Russia's place in the world, and so on. But it's, and so there are ideological differences, and Catherine mentioned the kind of Russian critique of Europe as totally decadent, permitting gay marriage and things like that. That's certainly there as an element in Russian culture. But it's not offering the kind of alternative it did in the Cold War, where, you know, central planning was going to be the answer to economic growth and a kind of equitable distribution of goods and of standards of living. In fact, a few months ago, a former finance minister in the Russian government, a man who's close to Putin, Alexei Kudrin, gave an absolutely scorching, devastating analysis of the state, not only of the Russian economy, but of the Russian state. He said, we now have we seem to be going at growing at an economic rate of maybe 2%. That's what we can look forward to. And we can't blame sanctions, and we can't blame external things. It's all to do with us ourselves. The failures of institutions, the failures of structure, the totally inadequate state administration, the fact that people are not, civil society is not allowed to take any kind of initiative. I mean, absolutely scathing criticism of the existing order in Russia. It's not saying, oh, we'd be fine if only the sanctions were lifted and so on. So, and what he's offering is not some panacea based on different principles. It's offering or recommending good management of a, you know, a market-based society in which entrepreneurship is allowed to play an appropriate role. I mean, it's very striking that when Russians who want to set up businesses go to Israel or come to California, they do extremely well, but not in Russia, where the conditions are very difficult. So I don't think we're not on an ideological conflict, except maybe around authoritarianism, whether authoritarian governments can do more than democratic governments. But I don't think Russia is a good example for that, because it's not carrying through the reforms that most economists would say are desperately needed. When you look at Russian arguments about international politics, it's all about geopolitics. It's all a kind of a realist view, and there's a whole critique developed by Putin about the West, in particular, taking advantage of Russia's weakness after the collapse of the Soviet Union, and of course NATO enlargement being part of that. But also democratic values are seen as a threat. So the color revolutions in Georgia and in Ukraine are seen as extremely dangerous for Russia. I remember after the Ukrainian, the Orange Revolution, I went to Moscow on a visit, and a friend of mine said, oh yes, this is your trial run for Russia. You know, you've done it in Ukraine, now you're going to do it in Russia. And that's an extremely dangerous mentality, I think. So I think there are elements, just to talk about Russia at the moment, that are rather dangerous, or at least present real problems for Russian neighbors, in particular for the West. One is the notion that Russia really is a great power. Russia cannot be Russia unless it's a great power. And I remember in the 1990s very often hearing Russians say to me, oh, we're very weak now, but Russia is condemned to be a great power. And the second is this sense of the fragility of the social basis of the order, that might be threatened by democratic ideas. And I think in China, I don't know, ask my colleagues, how far that's seen as a threat, but there's certainly a move against Western ideas coming in. And I think, if I may mention one more point, we talk about the collapse of the Soviet Union, and we think, oh, collapse of the Soviet Union, totally natural process. Of course people will choose freedom. But the way it's regarded in Russia, or I think in China, is to take it very seriously, especially in China, because that has relevance to our regime. What was it that caused the Soviet Union to collapse? And I think the conclusion that's been drawn is weak leadership and the dangers of trying to begin to reform an authoritarian system, or a system that's in power. And that makes the prospect of reform politically extremely difficult, because it seemed to raise enormous dangers for the system.
Okay, thanks. Tom, I don't want to take away your opportunity to comment on this, but I also want to just touch on the issue of military strategic balance and areas of cooperation, possibly, among these three relatively different powers. And
But my other point is I see Jonathan coasting around with a microphone, and I'm anxious to get some questions from the audience as well. So I think maybe we'll let Tom make his comments on what's been said, and if you can also just comment briefly on areas of cooperation, and then we'll open to the audience in our remaining 15 or 20 minutes or so. So, Tom?
I'm going to try and tie together some of the themes from the discussion thus far. One is to underscore that the world is very different than when President Nixon made the remarks that were played at the beginning. Today's world is not a bipolar world. And among the consequences of that is we still have old thinking that I call the seesaw view of international relations. If somebody's rising, somebody else must be going down. That's not clearly, it's clear that's not what's going on. We've got multiple countries doing much better. Doing better in some areas than other areas. We have friends. We don't really have enemies. We have competitors. We have partners. We have frenemies. That it's a very much muddle. The model or the structure of the international system is different. We're in transition from something that was to something that is undefined. We don't have a consensus in our own country about what the future order ought to look like, what our role ought to be in that system, what role we would like other countries to play in that system, how we might help to shape that future. And that makes it very difficult to have the kind of strategic vision, derivative policies that are very well represented in President Nixon's opening to China as a way of complicating Soviet calculus. So we run into a trap when we use concepts and terminology from yesterday to talk about the world of today and tomorrow. That the U.S., in my judgment, clearly does not have the influence, the soft power, the attraction that we once did. That's our fault. That's not the fault of somebody else. It doesn't mean that somebody else has got more attraction than we do. It reflects the somewhat chaotic, certainly ill-defined structure of the international system. And within that, still in Kuwait, still forming, still in transition from what we had to what comes next, shame on us if we're so complacent that we don't take an activist role. Shame on us if we don't seek to take advantage of opportunities to collaborate, which are many, that we don't address the points of friction before they become more serious tensions or possible military clashes, that there's, in my judgment, nothing about the current structure of the international order, as screwed up as it is, or as uncertain as it is, or having nobody in charge on many issues as it is, that dooms us to conflict with China or with Russia, dooms Russia to conflict with China. We have enormously more areas of congruent interest and cooperation with China than we have areas of conflict. We have far fewer with Russia. One could talk about the reason, but the possibilities are greater. And it's as was point made by David, it's a good thing that China and Russia have better relations than they've had in a long time. That is a stabilizing, not destabilizing factor.
Okay, great, thank you. In fact, one of our colleagues has written a book called Doomed to Cooperate about Russia and the United States with respect to nuclear power. So, Jonathan, I know you have the microphone open there.
Sure.
Shall we?
Thank you very much. We'll take a couple of questions from the audience. I think the first start off by asking, we have three pretty big personalities in the U.S., China, and Russia, U.S. being Donald Trump, China being Xi Jinping, and Russia being Vladimir Putin. How do these big personalities play a role in influencing trilateral relations?
Who wants to take that?
I can start.
This is your turn, Catherine.
Okay. Wow. Thank you. Okay. I made eye contact. So I actually think I will just comment on Putin and Trump, because I have met Mr. Putin, as I think David has, and I think this matters to a significant degree. As a cold-hearted social scientist, I was trained to think that personalities don't matter and that states have interests, not friends. But I do think that's true. We have interests ultimately. But clearly this matters, relationships matter a great deal to the current president of the United States, and he wants people to like him, and he evidently wants Vladimir Putin to like him. Now, why that's the case, I don't know. I'm not a psychologist, but I think Mr. Putin is intrigued. But he's also, he is many things, and we can use negative adjectives about him. But one thing Mr. Putin is not is stupid. He's very smart, and he's not necessarily strategic, but tactically he's very smart. So I think that he will use Mr. Trump's seeming eagerness to be liked and to be friends. To Russia's advantage. Mr. Putin is always very cognizant of what Russian interests are. And right now, Russian interests are getting rid of sanctions. They very much want those sanctions off, even though Mr. Putin will insist that they're not making any difference to the Russian economy. They're not helping the Russian economy. And one way that they're not helping is in attracting Western investment. And I think maybe Tom mentioned, David mentioned that Alexei Kudrin recently pointed out that the best Russia can do in future is grow about 2% a year. And they haven't hit that yet. They're about 0.5% right now for this quarter. So the only way Russia is going to grow, save from what has happened in the past, which is a huge spike in global oil prices, and that doesn't look likely in the imminent near future, is Western investment. Well, with sanctions on, it can't get that investment. And so this is a tremendous problem in the 1 to 3 to 5 year term. And what we will see happen in Russia is in 2018 there will be another presidential election, and my guess is Mr. Putin will run, even though he's kind of not sure. And he has to win, and I will predict, go out on a limb, that he will, but he has to make it look legitimate, right? So in order to make it look legitimate, he has to be the defender of Russian interests, that is, Russian interests against Western hedonism and culture, and therefore he must stop what is going on in Ukraine and keep Crimea. But he must also make the economy grow. People cannot eat prestige, right? People cannot eat Crimea, frankly. They actually will need to see real incomes go up again, or his ability to maintain order and stability in his country and the regime that he has built, which is cronyistic, and so he benefits, as do those around him immediately, from the state and controlling the state, they must perform. So there is some domestic politics, obviously, involved in their international stance. So I would say the relationship matters. My concern, as somebody who watches Russia and Mr. Putin, is that we have a political neophyte as our president who is very confident and perhaps overly confident in dealing with Mr. Putin, who has been in office for 17 years and quite successfully so, and who really knows what his country's interests are and knows how to work people. So. I think that personal relationship matters quite a lot, and I think we as Americans have reason to be a little concerned about it, to make sure our country's interests are served.
Maybe say a word about the U.S.-China relationship, and that is, point number one, is it's very clear that Chinese senior leadership, beginning with Xi Jinping, they were hopeful that Donald Trump would win. Secretary Clinton, Hillary Clinton, was extraordinarily unpopular with the Chinese senior leadership. She was looked at as the architect of America's so-called rebalance to Asia.
And the same, of course, in Russia.
2011, right. 2012. And so I think that they were then happy when they saw what the election results are. Second point would be that Xi Jinping and his team are facing a very consequential five-year party congress this fall. So one of the things that Xi Jinping does not want going into that congress is a frosty or very difficult relationship with the United States. Part of his scorecard is how is he managing that relationship. So is it possible we'll see a different relationship or a different set of policies from Xi Jinping with regard to the United States after it? I don't think we'd see an abrupt change, but clearly that's in his mind. Then the third point is with regard to President Trump. I think that as many world leaders right now, Xi Jinping is looking at President Trump, and they've heard a lot of rhetoric, a lot of policy goals stated, but they're at some point going to start to take stock of how many of those policy statements that he's making and the policy goals that he's trying to set, how many are being realized. And if not many are being realized or none are being realized, then at some point they're going to begin to discount. There's one other aspect of President Trump's administration that everyone here knows. There's not a lot of appointments being made right now. So if you go into the ranks of the Department of State, the Department of Defense, all those departments, Treasury, all those departments that are consequential in really managing the relations, not only with China, but all of our partners around the world, Xi Jinping doesn't micromanage Chinese foreign policy, nor does President Putin Russian policy, nor does President Trump or any president of the United States able to micromanage policy. Broad visions, and then the diplomats, the soldiers, the intelligence, those are the ones that go out and take the broad vision and they implement. And right now, the seats are empty. And I think that's a worrisome. And to get back to Xi Jinping, I know he's got a bureaucracy that's telling him that they're just not certain right now what is the policy of the United States. And generally, by this time, they'd have assistant secretaries of state, undersecretaries of state that they'd be meeting with, and then the policies of the two presidents, the two countries, would start to take shape.
Jonathan, what should we do? Throw it
back. A question in the back row.
President Obama reportedly told President-elect Trump that North Korea would be his single most difficult foreign policy issue in his first term as president. How do you understand how Russia and China, to what extent they're willing to help the United States or understand, or to what extent do they at present understand how fraught the Korean issue is with the president and a possible miscalculation? And is it really in their interest ultimately to get a solution that's favorable to the United States or to let it fester with the possibility that things might get out of control?
Great question. Tom?
Let me take the China piece of it. North Korea is truly an intractable problem. There are no good options. There are no magic bullet solutions. This is one I worked on from the 80s until last week. That it would be nice to think that China or Russia could solve the problem for the world, for the region. It's not possible. China has more leverage over North Korea than anybody else. That and $3 will get you a cup of coffee. They don't have enough leverage to produce results. The Chinese worry that in trying to pressure or prod an outcome around the nuclear weapons, around the nature of the regime, around the missile program, has a greater danger of destabilizing than of stabilizing the situation. There is better not to try, or not to try very hard. Try just enough to keep the Americans off your back, but not hard enough to produce a real danger of regime collapse, a danger of use of conventional weapons that can escalate into a nuclear exchange. That the need for cooperation in managing the diplomatic dimensions of this, the human suffering dimensions of this, China, the United States, I believe Russia, have to play a collective role. But at the moment, there is a lack of willingness to talk in specific terms about managing contingencies for fear of that word that we are talking to one another about possibilities in North Korea will trigger unwanted events in there. This is a real dilemma that doesn't have an obvious quick fix solution. My bottom line here is for China is we need to talk to the Chinese continuously about North Korea so that there is good understanding of how each of us sees developments, understands what each is doing or not doing and why, but not to have very high expectations.
If I could say something about the Russian attitude, which has received much less attention than the Chinese, and I think for good reasons. I think Russia, although it has an interest, has, for example, was much not very active in the, as I understand it, in the six-party talks that took place over a number of years. This is, for them, a worrying issue, but it's really China. China has the kind of major role to play in dealing with it. And I think some of the Russian apprehensions about action against North Korea would be the same as the Chinese. So one fear, of course, is destabilization on the Korean Peninsula. That's one aspect. Another, which some of my China specialist friends tell me is more important than we think, is that for China to, as it were, ditch or cooperate in moving against North Korea is difficult because that is, for all the hostility that exists between them, an ally and another communist state. But also, this third element, I think, is probably more important for the Russians, is what if indeed there is some kind of collapse of the regime in the north and a unified Korea with some American presence there, a unified Korea allied with the United States. Now, so I think the Russians have tried, not with huge success somehow, to integrate themselves into the economic dynamism of Northeast Asia. But on the security front, they are happy to have, I think, they have a good relationship with China. I think they wouldn't want to get out of step with China on the issue of North Korea. So let's leave China to deal with it. I think China is the key actor. Russia, I think if China wanted and the U.S. wanted, Russia would play some role. It wouldn't be in their interest, I think, to oppose what the Chinese want, given the current state of relations between Russia and China.
Carl.
Just briefly, so to follow up on what David had said, back to the Chinese perspective. So I think whether it's the United States, Russia, China, all agree that denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula is in each country's interest, global interest. The idea about putting a premium on stability, but the breakpoint between the United States and China, and I believe Russia as well, is that in the uncertainty then of a collapse of a North Korean regime, chaos, what would follow, then the Chinese worry, and I think the Russian worry, is that the peninsula would be reunified, and it'd be reunified on Seoul's terms. So as today, in Seoul, they worry about North Korea. I think a reunified peninsula, they would celebrate for about 24 hours, and then they'd start worrying about China. China's goal is to push back U.S. presence in the Western Pacific over the next 5, 10, 15, 20 years, not tomorrow, but longer term. And so they worry about the Korean Peninsula, which they've always seen in their vital national interest, as if there should be chaos, if it should then lead to reunification and the United States still an ally of the Republic of Korea, that would be worrisome, and I think it'd be worrisome to the Russians. A final footnote to this is we talk about triangles, probably informed by my two tours of military duty in the Korean Peninsula, is that as we talk about China, the United States, Russia, Japan, North Korea, never to forget South Korea, because at the end of the day, any U.S. policy is only going to go as far as our Democratic Republic of Korea allies want us to go, because they're the ones that live in the neighborhood.
Great. We have a question right here.
Getting back to tonight's theme, if President Trump articulated anything, both in the campaign subsequently taking over, I think it's safe to say he wanted a more confrontational approach to China and a less confrontational approach to Russia. And earlier this year, I saw on Fareed Zakaria's show, he had on a Russian journalist whose name escapes me, it was clearly a Putin surrogate, who said remarkably, I thought, he said he didn't think that would go very far because he thought that the rapprochement with China was so terribly important to Vladimir Putin. So I'd like you to comment on that. And I guess if President Trump takes the kind of go-it-alone approach that he's making or America's first, I think all of us would agree it was ironic that I think that the Chinese clearly like the current world order. And I think it's ironic that at Davos, which has sort of become symbolic of the world order and whatnot, the keynote speaker was President Xi.
Let me just say something about the Russian attitude to President Trump. There was a lot of coverage in our press about, I think, champagne bottles being popped in the Duma when the election results came in. And I think actually, yes, they were popped. But I was in Moscow not so recently, but in December after the election, and nobody I talked to took that point of view. They said, you know, we're very uncertain. Yes, he says nice things, but we don't know what that means. And one friend who's served in the Ministry of Defense said, yes, he's saying these nice things, but he's promising to build up the defense budget by enormous means. So what's this about? What's going on here? So the kind of most favorable prognostication I heard was the one that the television journalist made, namely that, yes, we might have a short honeymoon period, but then a lot of issues will emerge. Well, I don't think we've had a short honeymoon period, or at least it's been a very tempestuous honeymoon. Well, it's not a honeymoon at all, actually. I think the reasons are complex. It's not just because China is more important to the U.S., I think. But I'm not going to go into all the complicated aspects.
I'll add a couple of things on China. To frame the issue, one of the things that made our 2016 election unusual was that the business community, which for eight administrations was the strongest advocate of stability in U.S.-China relations. That sort of, you can have your rhetoric for elections, but afterwards, this is about money. This is about sunk costs. But the business community basically sat this out. Business community is not happy with Xi's basically China first policy. Theft of intellectual property, changing the rules again of not according national treatment to investment, the Made in China 2025 is in some ways the mirror image of Made in America for Mr. Trump. Under that, there really are some fundamental issues having to deal with reciprocity. They're global issues because of the approach that the United States has followed since 1947, 48, of accepting unequal trade relationships. Our market's more open than others because it made our partners strong, it made our alliances strong, it made us rich. It was a very smart policy. But the public clearly says, why are we still doing that? We won the Cold War. We're not getting richer anymore, the inequitable. So the demands for reciprocity, including by the business community, make China a legitimate target for U.S. You want to invest in the United States, only those areas that you allow us to invest in. I think we're going to see that, which is different than the kind of campaign examples that Mr. Trump used, but it's going to be there. That there are things that it's hard for me to imagine Mr. Trump making issues in human rights, the defense of constitutionalism. That just does not seem to be high on his agenda, and I'm sure that makes the Chinese happy. Taiwan, I don't think, but despite some developments right after the election, the phone call, I don't see a prospect for changing U.S. policy towards Taiwan or the mainland making that an issue. The key here is the economic interdependence and the ability to collaborate on a whole range of transnational issues. Because China, like the United States, is either a part of every problem or must be a part of any solution. On climate change, on water, on globalization, on demographic, on urbanization, it goes on and on. So here we really don't have any sensible prospect except to cooperate. I haven't got a clue which way Mr. Trump wants to jump on this.
I have a suggestion. Being a geologist, and most people, because of that, they say I have rocks on my head, but I'm hearing the idea of axes, of centers of rotation, and so on. And if we think about the world, looking at it from a distance, and looking at the centers of influence everywhere, you're pointing out the three that are most obvious to us all today, but what is it that changes the rotation? What disturbs an axis of rotation and makes it precess? Somebody like a Trump makes a lot of off-the-cuff notes that some people wonder about, but that has an influence. It affects things. And I hope that what you folks, you're so generous with your thoughts, I just hope that we can keep old folks like us to keep an eye on it and warn the youngsters that, look, the rotation is changing and is coming from people we never thought would change it. So read the news and keep an eye on it and listen to those who have experience. I'm glad you're here and I'm very appreciative of you being here. Thank you very much.
Hi, thank you for being here. So my question is more related to long term, not necessarily in with current situation. So besides soft power and financial interdependence, what elements would help the U.S. maintain its allies? So what are your thoughts on that?
Who wants to open that up? I have thoughts.
Well, I think Carl pointed at it earlier, which is getting our own house in order. That it's very hard to be a shining example for others when we have partisan political paralysis, when we can't seem to address issues from fixing the problems in our healthcare system to an aging infrastructure to an inadequate education system to the failure to retrain people who have been displaced by automation and movement of jobs to some other location. These are fixable problems. We have it within our financial and political capacity to do it. That we need to do it for ourselves. If we do it for ourselves, we go, in my view, a long way towards burnishing our credentials for leadership in the international system, the strength of the magnetic appeal of soft power, and have the capacity to provide the kinds of leadership that the world really needs. I'll end with one sentence which comes from Chinese a few years ago. I've been interacting with China for literally since the ping pong initiative that followed President Nixon's trip in 1972. The observation was the United States must continue to lead. We're not ready to lead. Nobody else is ready to lead. If we make a proposal, it's dead on arrival because we make it. You have thick skins. You're used to getting beat up. Our leaders can't afford to propose something that is laughed out of court. We worry about suffering economically, suffering in terms of the limited amount of international influence that we have. If we make a proposal that isn't accepted, or even worse, we launch an initiative that fails. So you have to take advantage of the technological, innovative, economic capacities, as well as the greater political capacity. I agree with that, but the prerequisite is physician, heal thyself.
Carl.
2 points on this. One would be that if there is a diffusion of global power that's underway right now, and indeed there is, Tom's point is well taken, though it gets overstated about how much ground the United States has lost. If you look at percentage of global wealth, the United States over the last 20 years has not lost a lot, but there has been a diffusion that has gone on away from allies and partners to other parts of the world. So one would be given that, and I think that it probably our standing economically in the world over the next 50 years would be one where it may come down further. So that's prioritization then. And the idea that in the 50s or 60s or 70s that we could move anywhere at will and set our priorities as we wished, those days I think are over. So when we look at places in Central Asia or parts of the Middle East, parts of the world, should we be more discriminating? And are there other regional powers that have much more vested interest and will credibly apply force than the United States? The second point is with the use of force by the United States of America. So we're gathered here in this library. The many accomplishments of President Richard Nixon was the establishment of the all-volunteer army and the all-volunteer force. I graduated from West Point in 1973, and the army that I entered was broken, and President Nixon knew this. And the move towards the all-volunteer force was a brilliant move. And President Nixon, he lived long enough to see how magnificent our armed forces became. But now I worry that far removed from this all-volunteer force creation in 1972 and 1973, that we've had several changes of generations in the United States since that era, and I worry about the disconnection of our armed forces with the American people. So to ask you the question that had we had a conscript force, a draft force, would we have gone into Iraq in 2003? And I think a case could be made, maybe not, because a lot of mothers and fathers would have been calling up their congressmen asking, what is this about? Certainly I know that 10 years after 9/11, we would not have had 100,000 troops in Afghanistan, which we did. And the reason for that is because it's an all-volunteer force, and mothers and fathers, they don't call because it's all volunteer. And so this breaking of the tissue between the American people and our Congress and our armed forces, I do worry about increasingly. So it's not to say that the volunteer force model was at all a mistake. By no means could we restore a draft, but we do as a nation, we have to start to think through this. How can you, us, do we get more skin in the game for the American military so that we don't end up with the phenomena which we have today, in which before the all-volunteer force was established, and the breakpoint after the all-volunteer force was established, we've had 5 times per annum the amount of military deployments into combat zones than we did before the volunteer force. And this is something, to get back to your question, that also needs to be addressed. We need the rejuvenation of America that Tom Finger talks about. We also have to think about our face to the world right now. And I'm afraid that too often, as we go around the world and we do our travels, there's a lot of the world that sees the primary face of the United States, not as Tommy Coe's New York Symphony, but in battle groups, Marines, and aircraft carriers.
Thank you, Catherine, and to our distinguished panel. Please give them a round of applause.
Thanks for listening to this panel from the Richard Nixon Foundation, brought to you by World Class at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford University. Follow us on Twitter at FSI Stanford or visit our website at fsi.stanford.edu for more events and expertise from the world of international studies.